heavy, and I'm with Greg Stolze and Kenneth Height and Monty Cook, and Scott Glancy is allegedly going to be here, but with great foresight, he scheduled a game at exactly this time. So his plan is to kill them off as quickly as possible, and hopefully in such a gruesome way that they'll enjoy it anyway. And then he'll join us sooner or later.
This is how they're ready.
So yeah. Maybe we can talk about what kind of gruesome death would you not mind having your game quit early over. But so what we'll do is, since we're here to talk about the Unspeakable Oath and Delta Green, what we can do is save the Delta Green stuff for a little while, because then maybe Scott will get here and he can talk about that with us, and we can kind of talk about what's going on with the Oath. And that's going to require a good bit of audience participation, because the big problem with telling everybody what we have planned for the Unspeakable Oath is that I have no idea what we have planned for the Unspeakable Oath.
The plan is I'll ask writers to submit stuff.
Yeah, that's basically
it. Then I will
take
the good stuff and
publish. What goes into the oath is what people send to us that I read and think is just really awesome, or that I put into the slush pile and kind of ask the other editors on that particular issue to look over and recommend. And it kind of goes through this filtering process. Usually it works like, I'll read the stuff, and if I think it has potential, I'll put it in front of the issue's editors, which is, often Dan Harms is always Game, and sometimes Greg, and sometimes, Adam Crossingham, and there's usually a good two or three veterans there. But it kind of goes through me, and then it goes through them. And if nobody in that chain thinks it's horrible, then we'll kind of proceed further with it, and I'll encourage the rest of the majestic editorial board that is the underpinnings of the Unspeakable Oath, even though they rarely do anything.
Hey.
And ask them to look it over. But
availability counts, Shane.
Oh, yeah. Fie. So
a name on a masthead is not nothing. Monty's written like a dozen paragraphs.
At least.
Yeah.
So for Monty, that's like, 9 minutes?
So what that means is that we don't really have a scheme. We don't have a grand plan for the Unspeakable Oath. Beyond, we really want people to submit stuff that's great, and then if it is, we'll publish it. So I can talk a little bit about some of the submissions that we have that we're looking at, but even that's not going to be all that helpful, because who knows? I might get home and have a big giant note from Dan Harms saying that this article I thought was interesting is full of holes. So what I think it would be more interesting to do is if any of you folks who are here, hopefully because you have an interest in the Unspeakable Oath, can talk about what kinds of things you'd love to see more of, then we can talk about whether that's feasible or not.
Yeah, it's not an entirely one-way avenue where, we send stuff to Shane and he, disposes of it. There's back and forth, and you want to write something that ties into Cult of Transcendence? Mm-hmm. You want to write something that shows people how to get into the DeMonte clan stuff from the last book in a different direction? Or do you want to write something that, what we haven't done is cowboys and mythos or something? So there was suddenly a huge burning desire for that. He'd throw it at the writers, and someone would say, "Well, I could do that."
Yeah, other than kind of specific things like that that come up and we get batted around internally, our submissions policy is really, really open. So,
except
so
no
we
fiction.
Just sort of, yeah, except for no fiction, unless it's really super short. So,
what was that again?
I said other than no fiction. Greg was complaining. We don't publish fiction except for like the last page of each issue is the one page, super short piece. So other than that, it's very good.
Cthulhu Mythos fiction is really hard to come by.
It's true.
There's always room for more.
There is.
It's like the Jell-O.
Apparently. Yeah.
That used to be true. That's the terrifying part.
I know.
You and I are of an age. No doubt had the exact same experience of crawling through used bookstores, hoping against hope to find a Ballantine adult fantasy.
Slogging through utter dreck to find that one
gem.
Yeah.
So,
all right. So, raise your hand if you are, you know, a fan of The Oath, if you've got, you know, a multiple issue purchaser, let's say. Okay, so we got a few.
Awesome.
What keeps you coming back? What, when you pick up, you know, a new Oath and, you know, see whatever gruesome cover Dennis has cooked up this for this issue, when you open it, you want to find what? And what has been there in the past that has brought you back? What have been, you know, the dazzle shots from Oaths Gone By?
Wasn't Grace Under Pressure originally an Oath?
Issue 2.
So I'm guessing Grace Under Pressure, what was the one that got me? The one with all the lunatics.
In Meteor Ray.
So. Got an answer for me? Frank.
I like all the stuff on the Hastur Mythos, the stuff about Carcosa.
It's going back to issue 1.
I have issue 1.
Yeah.
I have from the first day. I have every one of them since they came out. But I really liked that because it was a different look. What I like mostly about The Oath is something different. Hastur is not a tentacled monster, for example. And of course, John went great guns and countdown on that. And it's like, yeah, this makes a great deal of sense.
So reinvention, a different perspective.
Different perspective,
on some of the material because it can get kind of samey if you're not careful. Yeah.
Actually, along those lines, one of my favorite stuff is the stuff that only touches on the mythos, that lets it be distant and scary and remote. It seems like the more detail you get into about a particular thing, the more you know, the less it's scary. My favorites are the things that just touch on the edge of the mythos, and that seems to really make it more terrifying for me.
Can you name specific examples? Because that's I'm thinking of Meteor Ray again. Where, you know, it's never really explained because it's never really, that piece is not about explanation.
Right. The less explained, the better.
Mm-hmm.
On that note, it's a lot of the one-page things. Like, a typical issue on Speakable Oath is, like, 100 ideas. Mm-hmm. And I can take maybe 20 of them and use them, and the other 80 I just bang. But things like one-pagers on the Lost City of Z, the guy that went to South America and looked for the bat people and stuff like that, where it has just enough mythos connection and just enough real-world connection that I can insert whatever I need for my group. But there's like a dozen of those ideas in any given issue of Unspeakable Oath.
All right, so short, hooky stuff that is plastic enough to be attached to any particular individual's game.
Yes.
Or enough quantity of short stuff that there will be something you can use. So it doesn't bother you. You don't pick this up and think, man, I only use 20% of this.
I'm a lifetime gamer, so that 80% is going to be used someday.
Exactly.
I've gone back to issue 4 and dragged stuff out for current day games.
All right.
Kind of a counterpoint to what they both were saying is, although I like the freehand, you know, I like the, it touches on the mythos, but I can take it in whatever direction I want. If I want it to just be an unrelated ghost story, or if I want it to be full-on, you know, elder thing, our god, whatever. The thing I really like is the Bronson and friendlies that you had, especially this last issue. The NPC, the rare book keeper, she's awesome.
That was fun.
It even goes back to one of the characters from Countdown for Tiger Transit, the guy trying to escape the
and that was
Tendulous.
And that was,
and that, you know,
Shane
awesome
told me to do
tie.
That.
And you can throw that out, or you can keep it.
All right.
And then the same goes with the artifact. Any of the articles with artifacts are just awesome. You can just drop that right in as a total red herring to an existing scenario, or you can base a whole new string of games off that. Like, you know, the severed arm that was reanimated from the sapphire formula in the green box. Awesome. You know, that's going to throw the players off big time. I'm like, what the hell is this doing here? This has nothing to do with what we're trying to figure out right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the NPCs and the artifacts. Those are my favorite parts because you can just drop those in wherever you want.
Okay. Ross?
One thing I always liked is are the scenarios that are set in unusual time and places. Not 1920s Lovecraft Country, not modern FBI stuff. So, you know, I mean, Grace Under Pressure is one of those, In Media Res is another, and I'm blanking on others, but just things in 1930s Malaysia or whatever, you know, things that are unusual, because they're great for one-shots, and they expand the mythos beyond. I mean, Lovecraft Country is fine in the 1920s, but that's been done, you know.
That's been done a lot, and it's
yeah.
It's been done so much that it's very hard to do it outstandingly well.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I did, you know, an Aztec mythos thing where, oh yeah, you're all players in the ball game. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
It would not be hard to have that be the best mythos Aztec yeah. ball game scenario
ever written. Yeah.
I should write that one down.
I'll be easy, all right.
I'm still thinking about cowboys and mythos. That's I'm all for that.
Scott's got that one. I think didn't they already release that?
There was
Worlds of Cthulhu.
Yeah, there was.
That's right. Yeah, Worlds of Cthulhu had a big article.
It had a Indian shaman of Yig. I think it was set in the late 19th century, yeah. Early 20th century.
And yeah, one Valley of Guanji with it.
Like the wild bunch with those and snakes.
Mm-hmm.
I actually ran that; they all died.
Yeah. Okay.
I've been back friends with people from issue one way back, and I actually had a piece published a long time ago and wanted a whole article.
Uh-huh.
But Hunts People of Oath has generally been 1920s and modern stuff. Either when it was pagan was all doing sort of the Delta Green material of 1920s things thrown in. But since there seems to be this kind of historical renaissance of Cthulhu Invictus and the Gaslight Vaporware supposedly is supposed to come out sometime this fall. And then Cthulhu, Colonial Cthulhu from Miskatonic River Press is supposed to... Are you open to ideas that are not necessarily set in the traditional
1920s? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Era? Please.
I mean, that's been the kind of focus of the Unspeakable yeah. for most of its run.
Yeah, I mean, you know, most of... I know I have a few scenarios on the... You know, sort of on the burner, on the short list, that are fairly traditional in setting. You know, and I'm considering them because they're written really well. There's something about them that you know I just really get a kick out of. But if it's a setting that's surprising in some way, then that's bonus points without even having read the thing. So yeah, by all means. Now that said, it can be tricky because if you're wanting to do something that's tied explicitly to another another product, you know, mm-hmm. like something that requires Invictus to run, that's kind of points against because that reduces its utility for all the readers. So I would be really happy to have a scenario that was a self-contained piece that was set in Republic Rome or Imperial Rome and that you could, if you had Invictus, insert it into, but if you didn't have Invictus, you could still use that scenario and play a one-shot or play something that you might want to build onto something like, you know, something like that. So any material like that is great, especially if it can kind of stand on its own merits as a piece in the magazine that doesn't require you to have a lot of other resources beyond Call of Cthulhu and what you have in the article there. So yeah, send them, please. Yes, sir.
I also like the reviews where they're reviewing books, movies.
Oh, good. I was, you know, I was really, really on the fence for a long time about whether to bring that feature back, because unlike 1999 when the last issue came out, nowadays everybody has the internet, you know. And it's not hard to do a Google search for Machine Tractor Kharkov, whatever the rest of the title was, you know, and get a sense of what people thought about it. And so I was really on the fence about how much value a review column in the Oath was going to have. And ultimately, I kind of decided to keep it in because I felt like, well, yeah, you can do a Google search and read what a lot of people said in blogs about it. It takes a lot more work to narrow down which of those people that's writing the reviews has the same kind of perspective that you do as a Cthulhu gamer and are looking at it kind of from that perspective. And that ultimately is what kind of sold me on putting the Light and Darkness back in the...
Well, I know that when they had the original Unspeakable Oath, John Tynes did a review of a movie, and his was the only review I've ever read. It's called Clean Shaven. And I've got it on Netflix. And it has got to be one of the creepiest damn things I've ever seen.
Right.
But it's the fact that John went out of his way to review and actually look at a lot of movies we don't even hear about.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, from my perspective, the real benefit of the Isle of Light and Darkness is not... Yeah, if you know that a given product or movie or TV show or whatever it happens to be exists, sure, you can Google it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you didn't know...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then
right.
you've had, Pookie or whoever has gone to the trouble of assembling that... that sort of litany of things that you can then Google and then look up. And
yeah,
that
recommendations may be more
real
valuable.
Something
yeah.
really, really unknown and yeah. bizarre.
Troll
yeah, and I ought to say, on the Eye of Light and Darkness, I mean, we've done three new issues of the Resurrected Oath now, and I believe all of the reviews in those columns have been by the same two writers. And that's not by design. That's because they've been writing a lot of reviews, and I've enjoyed reading them. So I want to encourage people, if you want to submit reviews to the thing, you know, send them in. I won't promise to run them. But if you're a good writer and you have a perspective that's a lot of fun to read, then I want to see the material, and I'd love to put it in the magazine. Yeah.
With
regard to reviews, I think it's actually not bad if you have some consistency in who does them. Because with reviews, there's a lot of personal opinion going in there, even if the writer is good and puts the facts out as much as his opinion. And in my experience, I read a lot of reviews, and I like to read a couple of reviews from a person to see, do I have the same mindset? Is this something that I can use?
Yeah.
So if you keep changing them up all the time, it's like every time, okay, he finds this good and he has an opinion.
Right. Well, that's where writing reviews takes a lot of artistry if you want to write them well, because the key to writing a good review of something is to provide enough of a sense of what your perspective as a critic is within the body of that review that the person reading it has some sense of who you are and why you're thinking like that, and that's really hard to do.
The reader has to feel confident that he could disagree with you even without having seen the movie or read the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The other big advantage to having a steady reviewer like Pookie is that even if you think he's, you know, he reviews a product and he doesn't like it,
right.
if you've been reading his columns, you know where he's coming
exactly.
from. You can say,
yeah.
he might not like it, but I know why he doesn't like it, and I know that
yeah.
I would like this
yes.
thing he doesn't
yeah.
like. It's like
yeah.
reading Roger Ebert reviewing science fiction. He's a terrible science fiction reviewer, but because he's written so many movie reviews, you know exactly his perspective that he's bringing to it. You can say, okay, Ebert hated it because he couldn't understand the plot, which means it's interesting and multi-layered, so I want to.
So like I said, you know, I encourage you to submit the reviews, and you know, and
not
especially if you can, yeah, especially if you can, if you can. If you can pull off that trick of writing a review that gives a sense of who you are as a reviewer without it being, you know, a sort of wank fest as you're reading it, then bonus. Then I will promise to run it. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things I liked about reviews also is when you give it a context and almost like a historical perspective. I mean, one of the most controversial, I would always thought, so-called Lovecraft films was Cast a Deadly Spell.
Oh, yeah.
And the people I've talked with, they either really like it or they really don't. There doesn't seem to be much in the way. By the way, I'm one of the people that really liked it. Yeah. But it's, you know, but it's interesting to actually track, you know, when was it written? When did it come out? Because that's part of the context of a film.
Right.
Yeah, that's what's, I mean, I just finished
yeah.
watching.
Well, especially film. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just finished watching Winterset, the old 1930s, Burgess Meredith's first screen role. And it seems dated to a 21st century audience until you look at the time it was written in and who it was written about. Sacco and Vanzetti. It's the whole Maximil Anderson's. And you put it in that, and you also look at how films were made back in those days. Mm-hmm. They were stage plays on celluloid. It's all very dramatic. It was all very Broadway.
I'd like to ask a purely selfish question. If obviously, Call of Cthulhu is what brought the Unspeakable Oath into being. It's what keeps it, you know, it's the sun, the dark Azathoth around which the idiot flutists orbit. But
I would be one of those.
But if... just as a show of hands, if a resource or a scenario or whatever for Trail of Cthulhu... or Realms of Cthulhu, or one of the other Cthulhu Dark showed up in the thing, would that be an automatic, I don't want to see it, or would that be, I would like to see more of that.
Which one should they raise their hands?
Raise your hands if seeing that material is just kind of a waste of time, and you'd skip past it like it was used car ads.
And be honest, I mean, yeah. if you're a Call of Cthulhu head, and those other side systems waste
are
your
just
time,
dead to
say
you.
So. Yeah. They don't waste me because I'm you know because I dig them. But if they do, then that's perfectly cool. I'd like to know.
Now, how many of you would actually kind of like to see more scenarios or would like to see stuff
for the kind
for
of
the
other
kind of
approach.
Other
just to
approaches?
See a Cthulhu Dark scenario.
Yeah.
I mean, I just want to see what that would look like. It'd be longer than the rules.
Yeah,
yes, it would.
Yeah.
Yeah. And see where Trail of Cthulhu can go outside of its 1930s sort of
deep
boss.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 and I've encouraged Brian Walmsley today, in fact, to send stuff to the Oath, whether it's Trail or Cthulhu Dark or pretty much whatever else, because I like what he does.
I keep wanting to ask him if he's any relation to Gordon Walmsley, who did the translation of the Necronomicon. He's mentioned in some of Lovecraft's stories.
We'll have to ask Graham about that.
Yeah,
are your ancestors fictional, Graham?
Now that you look at it, you kind of look
fictional.
That's right. There are mornings when I get up and I feel like I'm a minor character, colorful character in a Quentin Tarantino movie. But
that's the trick: is to be the colorful character in the right director's movie.
I'm new to Cthulhu and role-playing in general, so take everything I say with a grain of salt.
Well, awesome. Welcome aboard.
This is
going to
be
that.
The best experience of your life.
That's right. You'll have warm memories.
Well, I don't necessarily like 25-page articles or footnotes or anything like that. I'd like to see some academic stuff about Lovecraft's influence. Oh. If you could do it like in a short matter, because you know, I've written some and I read a lot of pop academia stuff where it's not just so I'm going to quote so and so, but it's really getting at the core of the thing, and that to me helps me write stuff and understand stuff more than anything because it's all about the theme. If you attack the abstract concept first, then that can really inspire me to just you've got like unnatural horror, you also have impotence of human existence.
The key to me is definitely game utility because at the end of the day the Oath is about Cthulhu gaming. It's not even about Lovecraft per se. It's about the stuff that he made. And so
or borrowed.
But then it well yeah, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But but that said, getting back to Graham Walmsley again, he's got a book called Stealing Cthulhu now, which is at Pelgrane's booth if it hadn't sold out. That I just adore. I mean, what he did is he basically kind of went in and dissected, like a biologist, a lot of Lovecraft's classic Cthulhu mythos stories to sort of lay out what made each of them tick, you know. And reading that as, like, you know, a fiction reader, would probably be a terrible idea, because it would be like looking in the magician's, you know, under the magician's hat. But reading
unless
it from the perspective,
you're also a magician.
Well, yeah, but reading it, but that's kind of the thing. Reading it from the perspective of a game writer, it's loads of fun, because he kind of points out a lot of the sort of tropes that Lovecraft went back to and why in all of his stories, and then recommends ways to bring some of those to the forefront of your game in order to create a game that feels more like a Lovecraft story. And so if I could have that stuff in the Oath, I'd run it in a heartbeat, but he made a book instead.
Let me be discursive for a second. I got an e-reader, and one of the things you can get for free with your e-reader is the complete works of H.P. Lovecraft, which is just massive, thousands of pages. And so one of the things I did was I started going back to the earlier stories that, you know, I'd missed, and I read The Moon Bog, and I'm like, this is basically Rats in the Walls version 1. So then I went and compared with Rats in the Walls, and I'm like, wow, okay, so the framework, it's the same skeleton, but it's strung together in a very, very different way. And I think there's more going on in between those two stories than just that, you know, rats are more scary than frogs. So,
But I think to answer your question, I'd be happy to see stuff like that as game mastering tools, you know, the academic stuff that that you can read, and then and it has as an end result of that, there's direct application, you know, that you can make towards your
here's
games.
What
yeah,
he did, and here's how you do it.
Right.
And it,
yeah.
you probably it's not probably something you'd want in every issue, but. Every
yeah.
now and again,
I mean, if it was awesome,
scholarship.
If I loved it, I'd be the whole time.
I mean, I'm much more keen to turn like nonsense abstract ideas into stats.
Right.
To turn stats into like big deep nonsense little beans.
Stat blocks don't really interest me very much.
Yeah.
As much as sort of ideas for for when you're running a game, here's a trick.
Yeah, but what was like a three-part South Park episode about Cthulhu? I mean, I feel like Lovecraft's influence is ubiquitous more mm-hmm. than just gaming. And I feel like seeing where it's used in different media could mm-hmm. help gaming in response. So.
Well, yeah. That's sort of its own giant topic. But
yeah.
As a general principle, yeah, I totally agree with you.
Well, it ties into the review, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when you're reviewing not just movies, you're reviewing books, other various media. A new CD comes out from this artist, and they've got some wacky stuff that they're alluding to. You throw that type of thing, and you review it, and say, "Look, you know, this is madness in music. How do we want to do this?" You know.
With the reviews, it's kind of funny because these days there's never a shortage of new stuff that pertains to Lovecraft or Cthulhu.
Oh,
you know, I mean, we could have the Unspeakable Oath be 64 pages of reviews every quarter and not run out of material. So there again, the trick is basically encouraging reviews that kind of have a perspective that's unique or really useful for gamers.
All right, so how many of you, and this is just, the idea that has popped into my head this second, would want to see an article dissecting sort of the appearance of the mythos in popular culture, and how do you keep it from getting diluted? How do you keep it from... Write that down, dude. Remind me to write that article when I sober up.
Yeah, you could call it, what to do with Cthulhu now that he's a plushie.
Right.
That's an important point. So many other games give you ideas on how you can pull usable content out of the public domain, how you can make good things that you see in a movie, things that you read in a book, things that you see in a cartoon, into something playable. And I think Cthulhu has been around for so long, and a lot of the player base has been playing for so long that a lot of people are looking into real scenarios, like real adventures, because they might not have the time to prepare stuff, but it loses new gamers completely out of its perspective. If you want to learn playing an RPG, being a GM in an RPG, there's not much help that you get if you do any of the Cthulhu systems, unless you're willing to just live with what's out there and finish scenarios, which there's plenty of. But if you want to start making your own scenarios, just getting into it from an idea, none of the Cthulhu games give you really hands-on.
Here's how you build
one. This is how you make a stat block out of something that you read in a novel. This, because you need that stat block, because honestly, we're playing games with rules. So that would be something. I mean, I've been playing for a long time, but I play with a lot of new players in college, and that's something they always are annoyed of. That's the reason why a lot
of people end up playing games. Turn this to that?
Right, and that's why a lot of people play D&D 4, because they just tell you, this is your encounter rating, this is what's going to happen, this is the monsters, this is the group, this is how this works.
This is D&D 4 has the exact formula right there.
Right.
This is how you turn this to that.
Yes.
Follow these steps. And it's a recipe.
That's what most new GMs that I know love about it. It's idiot-proof in a way. It hampers your creativity, and there's certainly a middle way to go, but if you have every now and then an article that just helps people to, how do you turn my idea into a scenario, that will also help you.
Yeah, well, and especially because it's a double thing, because on the one hand, you're doing this with a genre that's been done to death, and you're doing it with a genre that has been parodied to death.
Mm.
And,
but it's
okay,
it won't stay dead.
Exactly. But also, it's horror, and there's an awful lot of kind of art that goes into trying to run a horror game, you know, where you're trying to evoke an emotional response, which is something you're usually not trying to do with most role-playing games, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's usually sort of, if that happens, that's a great day, you know, and that's sort of a goal,
right,
and everybody goes home happy, but that's not necessarily the goal of the night.
And it's not the core of the game experience. If you
right,
monster,
right.
It's nice if it was a
And yet the rules can only, even if they're really well targeted and well directed to evoke fear, which Call of Cthulhu's rules are, they only can go so far in doing that. And I think that has a lot to do with what you're saying, where if you're approaching it as a newcomer and you don't have the luxury of having been immersed in this kind of gaming forever, then how do you make that kind of intuitive, you know? And I don't know. I wouldn't say it's impossible. And I may be kind of overstating it, because I'm thinking back when I started playing Call of Cthulhu in 81 or 82... You know, I mean, it was me and my best friend, and we were both 12 years old, you know, and we had barely read Lovecraft, let alone played horror games. And yet the first Call of Cthulhu game we played, he ran it, and I was the player, and it was totally scary, you
know? Was this the one that's included in the main rule book?
The Haunting?
The Haunting?
Actually, no. It was one from the first edition about a cave with lots of deep ones, you know. And as a scenario, looking back on it as like a jaded publisher and all that, as a scenario, I would look at it as a really weak
the Crown
scenario.
And Shield Manor is what that one is.
Yeah, I think so.
Which one is it?
Crown and Shield Manor.
Yeah,
okay.
And it hasn't been in the rule books for ages,
right,
because it's kind of, you know,
it's terrible.
It's kind of generic. Yeah,
there is a house with deep ones in a cave underneath.
Right.
There.
Yeah. And
unless
yeah,
you're 12,
we were, you know, we were brand new to it.
I
know, and we
four
played
times
that. And it scared the hell out of me, you know. And especially at the end, I mean, part of that was the genius of my buddy. Again, only 12 years old, but, you know, he ended it with, you know, my character having sort of barely survived all that craziness and then getting just murdered without even a die roll at the end of the game. Which, again, as a game designer, you don't do that to a player.
And yet,
I'm still playing that game
30-something
years later, you know.
Clearly you're compelled to repeat your trial.
Right.
Yeah, I think another good article would be, how do you get them involved in the first place?
Ah, the Jessica Fletcher problem.
Well, yeah, because I remember, I think it's one of the modern-day Call of Cthulhu collections. Yeah, it is, as a matter of fact. And the scenario is called Love's Lonely Children. And it starts off with, and they find the body of this hooker in a trash barrel. And my first reaction as a player character would be, so what?
Call the police and go.
Shit, I gotta get out of here.
Call the cops if you're a nice guy.
Why should I care about, why should you care to get involved?
Mm-hmm.
I used to be a playtester with
my GM ran it in a double green game, and I was at the FBI detective with another detective. And we had been in, like, we had done some crazy stuff, went to other planets and knew about the mythos, but it came to our table, it came to our desk just like a normal FBI investigation. Now, Hooker was killed, might have been underage, so it's a sex crime, FBI called in, something, maybe a serial killer or something. And then you got immersed, found out that it was, might have been something mythosy. We didn't know until the monster came out. And
yeah.
Everything went to hell, and we burned down the building.
Another Saturday night.
So often the right answer.
Fires the cleanser.
A lot of that is sort of a
we survived.
A heritage from D&D, where you all meet in a tavern.
Yes. Well that's a convention because it works.
Right.
If I can't enable.
You started seeing other influences like cyberpunk, where the only reason why you're in that bar is to size up more victims. You're not there to find buddies.
Well, that was, in a way, that was kind of the point of Delta Green specifically, to give you an excuse to have people investigate stuff that ordinary human beings would never go near.
You can't pass it off to somebody else once you figure out what the problem is. You're Delta Green.
Right.
Crap. I'm the expert.
It definitely gets a little more challenging, though, outside of a game with that framework, where you're not playing characters who are part of some knowing thing where they have sort of a crusade to do just that, That gets a lot more challenging, and GMs, sometimes can use more guidance. I mean, a lot of times, let's face it, when you're playing with role players, you're there to play a game, and when they run into the dead hooker in the alley, and that's a thing that you as the GM say they run into, they're gamers and they're going to play the game and they're going to say, "Oh, there's a dead hooker. We must have
searcher for treasure."
Yes, we must search for treasure. And oops, it's a monster.
There's really only so far you can go as a game designer to provide that kind of hook. It's kind of often up to the game master, because only the game master knows the characters, right? Only he knows what's going to motivate them, what's going to inspire them, what they're linked to, what they're not linked to, and the game designer can't know that. So
you have to write for this sort of hypothetical investigator with a capital I.
Right, exactly.
I think he's suggesting that's exactly the point, because if you run games for a long time, you know how you take the starting scene of an adventure and make a hook that works for your group because you have played for a long time. But if you're a new GM, it would be nice. I think all these kind of directly applicable helps, like, for example, how do you analyze what characters do you have in your group? Even more important, how do you analyze what players you have in your group?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think gets your players hooked? And I think that's something that's, in a way, you're right, it's an acquired skill, and it's an art up to a certain point.
Just get Robin to do a Robin's Laws of good Cthulhu
game. Right, and that's exactly why it would benefit from having some guidance for new players. Sure.
How would you react if there was a issue that is, okay, you're a new GM, we're here for you?
I think one of the things with Call of Cthulhu, as opposed to a lot of other games, you can have a number of, how do I run a challenging D&D adventure and lose weight at the same time? You've got the awesome GM tools out there, and after a certain point, I don't read them anymore. I've been doing this since third grade, whatever. Mm-hmm. However, if I think of a Call of Cthulhu directive or idea that says, hey, here's a cool tool, here's something you can do to pick up this stuff. I stumbled upon, I think it is John Tynes, some of his old website stuff about scaring the crap out of people. And I'm like, wow, I've done four of these things. It worked. This is awesome. But I never get tired of reading, how do I make Call of Cthulhu work for me? I got guys that play with these guys for 20 years. It is hell to scare them. Mm-hmm. It is super hell to scare them. I can do it every once in a while, but those articles, for me, I won't get tired of reading. You could have one every issue. I eat it up every
time. Well, S. John Ross used to say that cooking magazines don't stop running chocolate chip cookie recipes.
No. This isn't Dragon Magazine. If it was Dragon Magazine, you'd be like, please stop. I know how to run a game. Mm-hmm. But this is Call of Cthulhu, and there's such an art to it, and it's difficult to be, a first timer.
Sure.
If this is your first cutting your teeth on this baby, it's going to be tough.
Yeah, I would say that my players are rarely ever scared. They don't want the characters to die, but they're rarely ever actually scared because they're sitting in, a basement or a family room just playing a game.
Right. There's your problem. I use a concrete cube.
Pungy steaks. We've got poison
chasing to the bottom of an empty swimming pool.
Not to mention,
then they're scared.
Not to mention the blood.
I was also going to mention that for Call of Cthulhu especially, having new tools constantly is kind of important, because as soon as you get good at running something well in Call of Cthulhu, your players are now jaded to it, so you need a new one. Mm-hmm. Like, so as soon as you master a style of a trick for getting something to work, it's already obsolete.
You can never stop. You can never rest.
So there's no end to the
number
of
useful tricks. You're never good at it.
So like those articles, I don't think would ever
You'll
get
You'll never be good enough, Shane.
Cthulhu, like they would for D&D, because after a certain point in D&D, it's like you know how to run an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
That's you got them hooked.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who's that? Someone.
You were up first.
I don't know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
We ran a game, and I designed this big monster, and I don't know what I'm doing. And I got online, and I found the Delta Green box generator, where you're just like, I want this many of this, and it gives you a big thing. And I had 20 things, and I rolled 20-sided dice, and I get it. And I designed some horrible monster, and then one of the things that just comes up randomly is a parrot that's been alive in this box. There's just a parrot in a uh-huh. cage. And like they're like, what's it say? Squawk. And like I leave the room. I lock them. Like it's terrifying. And I'm like, hey,
there
like,
must be something
the monster
really bad
comes out. They're like, oh, I got 90% of shotgun. I blow it away. But like this parrot, they're just like, can we put lead around it?
It's like the gazebo story, but with a parrot.
Yeah. Like, if you want like a short feature, like uh-huh. I feel like. Now that I've done it a little bit, I feel like the little immersement stuff, like the
incongruity,
like a top 10 regular thing that is slightly off that you can throw into your game.
Well, what you had there when you're boiling it down, right, is you had a them encounter something that was unknown and maybe unknowable.
Yeah.
And because they're playing Call of Cthulhu, that implies it's horribly awful at the same
time.
Yeah,
you drop a can of soda and it rolls up a hill.
Even if
like,
it's a parrot and there's nothing bad about it except it's not dead.
Just way more than, oh, it's got tentacles.
Yeah, like, you know, 10 creepy things would be an awesome.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. But the thing is, that's why, because all the tentacles, all the monsters in the Call of Cthulhu rulebook for most Call of Cthulhu players, because a lot of us have been playing for so long,
we know
all of them backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
They're not unknowable. They're not unknown. We know exactly what they
do. Yeah, but like a 10 creepy things to throw in would be a nifty thing to throw in the letters column.
And even if they don't, even if you create your own new monster, right, because it's a game, the players know, okay, it's going to have hit points, right, it's going to have a strength score. And so by the very fact that it's a game, you are making the unknowable knowable.
To
but the weird
to a
parrot
certain extent.
Who's just sitting there in a cage, all of a sudden that kind of feels like that paradigm has shifted.
They lost.
Yeah,
them.
And
like,
that's
I
great.
Wrote
yeah.
70 pages and the parrot that I pulled off online was just
right.
in the game.
Yes, that's genius. I love it.
Who was next?
Go ahead.
To this point, what I'd mentioned before about the random artifacts like the arm, the severed arm that's moving on its own in the green box. Things like that, because it takes the players away from the kick the door in, kill the monster, take the stuff, and it turns it into a, well, forget about the Mygo moon base, why is this arm in here moving around? Because that's what they're going to, it's the unknowable of the game, I can't figure this out. Every player wants to figure things out. A plus B has to equal C.
Mm-hmm.
And when they play Cthulhu, it doesn't.
Yeah. A plus B equals 4.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Or, maybe -1.
Not your Earth 4.
So, not only how do you, what is that tool you can add, right? It's a severed arm, it's a parrot.
Well,
but how the heck do I recognize it when I'm doing it? Because if I did that with a parrot, I've been doing this, again, for a real long time. That's the crazy thing. It's parrots today. They love parrots. If I've not done it before, and it happens to me, I may go, how the, what was that? If it,
The article concept, of course, is that how do you recognize when you've made something unknowable, right? I now know it. They don't. I now know the unknowable.
You just made my brain hurt.
How do you recognize when you've got it? And what the hell do you do with it?
How do you know, the unknowable when no one else
knows? I just don't know.
I know, but I can't tell you.
That's right.
If you all want to read what I regard as one of the best Call of Cthulhu scenarios ever written for sheer creepiness, read one called The Night Floors. It's at the back of Delta Green Countdown. That is weirdness personified.
That may be online on Dennis Detwiller's website, as a matter of fact. Is it on there?
That was just super fine.
Mm-hmm. I think the best way to add it is a random thing in like that. Is, and I think it would be a good article for them to speak of Oath would be a document or like an autopsy report or an arrest report, a newspaper article, something you can print out like and count down. There were some autopsy reports of deep ones, and I think in World of Cthulhu somebody carried it on.
Same guy, Grant Price.
Yes, who's terrific.
Right, who's actually a virologist.
Hand it to your players and say, this is what you found, and they'll freak out. They'll say, what? Well, how come this DNA analysis doesn't make sense?
More work for Graham. All right.
I always loved the props in the Delta Green. Props and handouts. Props and handouts.
Hey, Scott, any survivors?
They ended up on takeoff with the Hadley Page bomber, losing their landing gear in a tree. They fumbled the takeoff roll. So at the beginning of the bomber mission, they realized that they were going to have to, before they could land, they were going to have to detach the landing gear. The non-retractable World War I landing gear, and then let those that fall away so they could do a belly landing in an open field. They eventually got to do that. 4 out of 5 survived. Everybody got mangled, and the dead guy died primarily because one of the players fumbled his shot roll and shot the player and not the monster. The best role was though when they blew up a creature with a Lewis gun, and both pilots and the nose gunner were all blinded as they all fumbled their luck roll, and the guts from the creature splashed into their faces, and they spent the next round trying to get the guts out of their eyes. It was fun.
We got to go for this guy in the back. He's been very patient.
This is actually for Monty. You did the Chandler Chronicles, is that the ongoing thing? Are you ever going to do anything else with that, or write it up at some point or another? As
well, it's back. I'm doing it again.
It's back in GTM.
Yeah. If the timeline's been advanced to pre World War II, and Aleister Crowley is involved, but it's still going on. We've talked about possibly collecting them all and making it a standalone book, but.
You didn't go that far because, I mean, there's a lot of us who don't get access to GTM.
I understand. Yeah, it is on the website, too.
Is it?
If you go to their website, I think you can get all of the original series, and I know that they're updating monthly all the new installments.
Do you have to only write that for them, or can you branch it out to do something else with the same character?
Well, I own it, so I can, yeah.
They have no rights.
Yeah. Let me get one more, and then from Heinz, and then I think we ought to switch gears now that the talented Adam Scott Glancy is with us, and talk about the other half of this stuff.
I have two questions, in fact. So for one, not that we were usually playing in Germany, I completely missed the fact that the Unspeakable Oath is back. So
the Unspeakable Oath is back.
Yeah. I found this out really when I went to my gender. Oh, wow, that's interesting. So it would be nice if you could get the word out a little more. And the other question is...
That's your job. Blog, damn you.
Yes. Blog like the wind.
I don't have friends.
Blog like the wind.
So I'll make that an official request, by the way. Anybody wants to help us get the word out about the Unspeakable Oath being back?
Especially if you have friends in Germany, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. Tying in the second question.
Your Google Plus Germany circle.
I know it's always a kind of a pain in the butt if you have so many authors contributing, but what about actually making it available for sale as PDF?
It is for sale.
What a great idea.
I didn't know that.
You mean the Oath or
Call of Cthulhu? We're going to have that.
Yeah. Just a completely
Go to the website, the unspeakableoath.com, and there's links on there on the side for issue 18 in print, issue 18 in PDF, whatever you got.
Oh, you have a website.
So you have the back issues as PDFs too?
Oh, goodness.
No, he's talking about 74, no.
Yeah, no, it's we've got 18, we've got 19, we've got 20. So basically, the first set, the initial 10-year run that Pagan did was under totally different contractual terms. Mm. So I would have to go back to all of the writers and all of the artists and make sure
they're
clear.
Like anarchist syndicate commune.
It's the same problem as we've done the reading.
Every author, every artist owned the rights to their art. For us to go back and reprint stuff meant tracking people down from 10 years ago and paying them again.
Yeah, the ownership isn't as much of a problem as the terms were one use. Yeah. I mean, with the Unspeakable Oath these days, everything is still creator owned.
Yep.
But, you know, I extract permission to do whatever I want with the material.
Wait, what?
Sign
see,
the
that's
contract.
An article in itself. An extraction of rights and
privileges.
You know, it's still everything creator owned. But I make sure everybody knows that, you know, we want reprint rights so that we don't get into the same bind. But with the old material, that's kind of the deal. Is we'd need to go at, you know, we'd have to. We'd have to do it piecemeal, because inevitably there's going to be writers that aren't available, aren't interested, the material's been given to Chaosium and therefore not owned by them anymore, whatever.
Okay. All right, so should we shift gears and Scott can talk about the plans to relaunch Delta Green based on Ayn Rand instead of...
Yes, I believe that is exactly correct.
You were inspired by the film.
Yes. It inspired me to go to the nearest green box and maybe blow up the theater.
Oh, just a severed arm and a parrot. This sucks. But that was still the most entertaining showing. Because there was a parrot and a severed arm.
So, tell the people about our big plans for Delta Green.
Big plans for Delta Green. The big plans for Delta Green is that, we are going to be, and various people up here have started filling away in their, toiling away in their basements, stylish Chicago apartments.
Townhouse,
thank you. In skies. Working on a way to bring Delta Green up to the new millennium, as it were, take the things that we're all afraid of now. Because back in the 90s when it was written, apparently we were all supposed to be afraid of government because this Bill Clinton guy was completely out of control or something. It was the age of, no more commies and we're all going to be afraid of our own government and, FEMA was going to take over. Clearly they had the capacity to see at any moment.
With their terrifying efficiency, nothing could stop them.
Nothing would happen for a year, and then New Orleans would be out of water.
They could make that work. There's a drought in New Orleans. What will we drink? We're trying to bring it forward. We're trying to basically try and cover the area between, I guess, when the World Trade Center falls over and Bin Laden gets shot in the eyeball. Try and cover that period and bring up sort of the new set of things that we're all afraid of and don't want them creeping through our walls and telephone lines and bedrooms, and do some structural changes to the mythology and to the setting to sort of accommodate not just the sort of changes in history, but also in the changes in the zeitgeist that currently powers our civilization, but also there's some thoughts that have been put forward about internationalizing it in some ways to have the problem of everybody wanting their own. Why can't we have an Italian Delta Green? Why can't there be a Botswanan version of Delta Green, or Ireland, or Israel, or any number of other fans who've been
Italian Delta Green would be so stylish.
That's right. My favorite was My favorite was the Irish submission, who they wrote this giant thing and sent it with their Irish version of Delta Green, where they would be fortified against the mythos with Guinness.
Was this written by an Irish person?
Yes, actually it was. Now that you mention it.
Perhaps someone fortified against the mythos.
But the two things we're looking forward to do, the two things we're going to do with this is there is some thoughts to making this a standalone RPG system. Taking the mechanics out, not using the BRP mechanics, and finding some mechanics that will be homegrown that we can, you know, sort of sculpt top to bottom, or finding a system that exists that we like. And there's still, I guess, there's still some debate about which system, but I know what I'm leaning.
We've gone back and forth over. Over a shockingly long period of time on this topic.
It's only shocking to people who've just started.
Right. So what I'm kind of leaning towards very heavily at this point is taking advantage of the open gaming license and the amount of the BRP itself that's out there, and essentially kind of kledging together a version that will kind of play to what Delta Green is all about,
and still be 90% back compatible,
and be as back compatible as possible, so you can take a stat block out of the 1997 Delta Green book and play it with the 2012.
And the reason to do this is because the Chaosium license winds up restricting flexibility in printing and reprinting,
yeah,
and providing
and
support
for
undoing a core book to begin with.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
So the
reason to do that is not just because we're all drunk with power and think that we're better than Sandy Peterson. That would just be Monty and me.
That's not the only reason.
it's because it provides the game and the setting a lot more flexibility going forward in the future.
Yeah.
If we can support it that way without having to cross eyes and dot T's.
It gives us the luxury of sort of tailoring gameplay kind of specifically to what we have in mind when we talk about Delta Green, because it doesn't really play like ordinary Call of Cthulhu. You know, it plays. There are some similarities, but ultimately there's a lot of stuff that tends to go on in a Delta Green game that wouldn't go on in a normal Call of Cthulhu game.
Mm-hmm.
And there are elements of the setting that I think we can take advantage of, and for games that are a lot more powerful that are not really addressed at all.
You don't mean, oh boy, I'm now 80th level.
No, I mean emotionally powerful. You know, I mean in terms of establishing characters in their world, establishing what price they're paying for what they do in Delta Green beyond their hit points and sanity points. That would be hard to make that back compatible.
But add a new rule set to it. Is it like a Paizo core rule book?
This is going to be a new book, and so it's not going to be the original Delta Green book plus chapters of rules.
We're going to have to do a lot of rewriting about all those agencies in the back of the book. It's all going to be updated to the current alphabet soup organizations.
Yeah.
Post 9/11.
And the exact form that this is going to take. I don't want to promise anything because we don't have it set in stone. We're still debating back and forth, kind of what's the best approach.
I have suggested that for those of you guys who own the basic rules of Delta Green already, the basic core book for BRP, that maybe we come up with either a standalone publication or maybe a PDF would be better. That would be everything that's been added. That, you know, everything's been changed from one edition to the other, rather than having to buy. If you want to find out, oh, what's next new for Delta Green, going to have to buy the whole $40 book. You can buy something small that's just the updated materials.
Yeah, there's a long, how complicated your rules system is. Well, yeah,
yeah.
I mean, there's a long history in publishing of screwing over the past owners and encouraging them to buy the new edition, whether they want to or not.
We haven't come up with
that. But then again, we're nowhere near that skillful. So we'll probably put stuff out that will lose us money. for the sake of allowing you to not have to pay it.
Yeah. Wait, that's your business plan?
Yeah. Isn't it a smart one?
Well, it makes me feel good. I'll buy the $40 book anyway.
Yeah.
All right.
If that helps, you got my $40. So.
If you buy both, then we win.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I remember talking to you before, and there's a lot of things with rights about Delta Green. Can you keep all the background, all the organizations that was in there, or do you have to drop?
Nothing is in, there's nothing in the material, in the source book material, the background material. Outside the mechanics, that's Chaos.
Okay.
Chaos uploads all the mechanics.
So you don't have to retcon
it. The only thing that we might have to do, we're gonna be really careful about it. And frankly, I don't think it was an issue with Savage Worlds or with Savage Worlds Cthulhu stuff or Trail of Cthulhu. Maybe we can go back and, you know, not use the names of critters or spells that are Chaos and Material. That's different.
Yeah, both Realms and Trail work under Call of Cthulhu licenses.
Okay.
So that's why they can copy everything.
The one thing that would be a barrier would be the names of spells and names of certain creatures that are not from Lovecraft core materials.
Yeah.
And then again, I mean, the
we're not necessarily going to be able to get the rights to Brian Lumley.
No. Mm-hmm.
So we may have to rename Chthonians as case, I forget what they are in Laundry, but we'll.
Yeah, okay. Well, then we have to pay Charles Strauss. Another Englishman. I was just helping.
He's a Scotsman. You call him an Englishman, you're never going to get the right.
you can always call him Graboids.
Right.
Then we have to hear from Kevin Bacon. Come on, let's.
Earthquake worms.
Yes, sir.
So I'm not entirely clear here. This is an update taking the present established history of the organization, bring it forward,
yes,
or a reinvention of the organization?
No. What you'd have is in Delta Green, the role-playing game, you're going to have a book that'll give you a history of what Delta Green has looked like since its inception into the present day, with the present day being sort of a nebulously defined more or less early 2010s. And so it's something that you'll be able to use on its own merits without having access to all the other stuff, but you'll be able to augment it with all the other stuff that's out there. At the same time, because that's going to include material from the 2000s and the 2010s, that's going to, you know, at the same time, we're looking at basically having a separate publication that's just that stuff, that is sort of a supplement to the 1997 Delta Green that takes the timeline and moves it forward some with, you know, what we, meaning mainly Scott and Dennis, at this point, have in mind for the shape of the shape.
That's not true anymore, because Shane's done so much work that he is... He has wormed his way into this. Not worm sounds like it's duplicitous. Shane's done so much work.
Snake.
he has muled his way in.
Like termites. R.I.P. Yeah, that's what it's like.
Well, how does this sound? That you're not going to reinvent the you're not going to reinvent the canonical events, but you might wind up reinventing the tone and the themes.
I don't want to reinvent the tone of the themes. I love the tone of the themes.
I like my tone.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And reinventing I'm not even looking at reinventing the canon, because the canon's already out there. And you know, as much as giving a sense of what Delta Green looks like nowadays and why it's not the same as in the 1990s and why it's so much less convenient and pleasant than it was in the 1990s.
Back in the good old days.
Back in the day.
So is that sort of the direction that, like, post 9/11 with Homeland Security and increased oversight and whatnot, that it's harder to be a Delta Green agent?
It's one glorious bureaucratic fuck up after another, yes.
Oh, so you're not entering like Fatagan into your voicemail searching super.
No. I mean, there's another game that does that beautifully.
It's more difficult to be an agent.
The Laundry, and I encourage you to buy it and play it, but that's not Delta Green.
Okay.
And it's the themes are very, very different.
One of the ideas that's been kicked around for a while is sort of a way to sort of almost trifurcate giving to the players different play options that will allow them to have to play Delta Green almost like they played it in the 90s, or as the 90s game was envisioned, But also at the same time, and in the same canonical world, not getting a great a way for you to play Delta Green where it is a little closer to almost legitimate, an almost legitimate agency, an almost legitimate operation, but at the same time you can still play, and again in that same world, play Delta Green as that sort of rogue organization or rogue conspiracy of individuals, not an actual agency. I mean, it was never, we never had it as an agency, it was always a secret society. And even a third option for playing sort of Delta Green people who are ex-members of the conspiracy. A way to create games where you play people who perhaps assisted Delta Green in the past and got sick of it and are now still perhaps fighting the good fight, but aren't fighting it inside the structure at all. But out there in the world are these structures that they're going to be stuck having to deal with.
And in some fashion. Yeah, the key to all of that, though, is that the differences between sort of those three main approaches basically comes down to what kind of a campaign do you want to run, and because each of them is going to have its own feel and its own tone. But none of them is going to make your player characters any happier than any of the others. I mean, if you play as we are the version of Delta Green that has sort of...
a budget.
To borrow a phrase, wormed its way back into the good graces of some secret elements of the United States government, and we have a budget, and we have authority, and we have badges...
I don't have to tell all these lies to my superior officers.
Well, that sounds great, except that you've got oversight and you've got people looking over your shoulders, and you've got a lot of pressures to not actually destroy that horrible supernatural threat, because if it's that scary and dangerous, then my goodness, that could benefit national security if we bring it under control. But the difference is going to be in what kind of a game you want to play, mm-hmm. and where you want to play your paranoias in your game. And if you want to play the sort of classic Delta Green, where your characters are kind of part of, more or less part of the government, and yet they're kind of using and abusing their positions secretly to investigate and fight the good fight, then that's feasible. If you want to play one where, where they have more access to that stuff, and yet they're also under much more immediate threats because of that access, and you want to kind of play up the bureaucratic stuff, then that's going to be an option, too.
Yeah, and again, the one thing that we're... one of the things that always informs me when we're talking about this is I don't want to build a canon that starts to look like World of Darkness, where the NPCs are having a more interesting time than the players.
Mm.
At least that was always my feeling about some of that World of Darkness stuff before they hit the reboot button. It didn't feel like... It felt like there was a story going on that perhaps the player characters weren't invited to. Even the game...
Do you want to be Rosencrantz or Guildenstern?
Yeah. So the plan is to make sure that whatever canonical structures we create for this updated Delta Green... the person who's in charge of deciding how this story turns out is you and your game group. And however it turns out, your table is how it turns out.
Are you gonna set it up so that there will be adventures you can play through from the, starting at the end of the last published Delta Green material? The last piece of canonical stuff was probably that had a really... firm timestamp on it was probably your Hurricane Katrina stuff with the...
Well, the Hurricane Katrina stuff actually is going to be... That's a good... I wrote that. I said it in post-Katrina. But in some ways, that scenario, that sequence, the whole hunting ghouls in the ruins of New Orleans, you could play that as either the classic Delta Green guys are doing this in their spare time, or you could run it even as the... You could even run it as both versions of Delta Green, even the you can reorganize a little writing and make it part of the either I don't know what to call it, not an aspect of Delta Green, but another each vision of Delta Green. Mm-hmm. You know, that can be adapted. That I think that's going to be easily adapted into this timeline, even if we pull the timeline back so we start changing things prior to September 2001. And the changes that are going to happen in this world are going to need to be happening before then, maybe accelerated by the interruption of 9/11. But I don't think there. I that material does not. That material existed in post 2002, set in that post Katrina, shouldn't be seen as a sign that Delta Green is not going to have any changes until 2002.
Yeah, I mean, our touchstones with this are always, number one, because this is about Delta Green, it's about characters who are trying to do good things and suffering for it, and who don't have anywhere near the resources that they think they ought to have, and if they get to those resources, they're going to regret it. And
thus making it very similar to the average Call of Cthulhu game.
But number two, our other big touchstone is, you know, we want it to be backwards compatible with what's already there, and we want it to be useful for players whose tastes and styles have kind of evolved.
Yeah.
You know. So. So yeah, that's
plus
those are sort of
trying
the
to attract people to the
principles.
Game when we built it around some of that 1990s government conspiracy zeitgeist that was, you know, kept the X-Files on TV long after it should have been canceled. Mm-hmm. Hey, I was in love once too, but they broke my heart.
One too many times.
That kind of stuff is in fact old data now. But God knows we've got all kinds of new shit to scare us.
Oh yeah, there's lots out there that's gonna be really ripe
that
for
Washington
mining.
Washington Post thing about Secret America, where you find out how much of our spooks don't work for the government anymore. They're just on-call contractors. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or the one guy who has to sit on all the committees, and so they basically run the PowerPoint slides that, you know, one slide per second so that he can be read in.
Right. Right.
He shows you everything. Okay, now
yes. And he's like, and they interview him, the thing is, he says, you just tune out after about 10 minutes. And so they're showing all this stuff, and he's like, yeah, okay, that's
we
all
good.
We
say the one guy, don't you mean the senator?
Yeah, right.
I mean, it was like, you know, somebody on one of the House, the Senate committees, where it's like, okay, we're going to show you what we're up to. Okay, we're done now.
That's right. And, you know, somewhere in, you know, slide 814 was the MIGO corpse.
Okay. The next time we do that, do you have one of those clockwork orange sets where you can dry my eyelids open?
Just for minority members of the panel. Vico treatment.
Well, you guys, what I'd like to see happen, and we talked about it before, is expanding Delta Green internationally, but in a way that makes sense.
Well,
because I always wondered when SV8 was actually going to make contact again with Delta Green.
That's, you know, what I want to do with that, though, is I always want the fucking players to do it. I've set up SV8, I've set up Pisces. Okay, you're in Delta Green. Get your goddamn, you know, keeper to run some games where you're running into some Russians and some Brits, and now you make that connection. I don't want to tell you how it turned out. Well, it was a success. Well, it was a failure. You know, and then the player's like, well, when we did it, we just shot the Russians and, you know, burned their bodies. Is that the wrong thing to do? They had accents. We were... But the British guys we trust. You know, they're good stuff. Yeah, those guys had good, solid...
Even if they've got bugs in their brains.
Exactly, you know. Oops, small detail. They have bugs in their brains. You know, the Russians have bad teeth and bad skin and, you know, look shifty and their clothes are all threadbare. So we killed them, you know. I want them to find out how this stuff turns out. I don't want to knit it so tight that, you know, your players can't fuck up the Grand Alliance.
Yeah, there's not going to be a meta plot.
Well, but
there's going to be a history of sort of what were the big ticket issues and events that shaped what Delta Green looks like as we envision it. Now,
if you look at the history of American relations with Russia and even American relations with Britain since 1997, they go all over the map. And it's not like we, you know, no, I'm sorry, my players are going to offend Russia and wreck our relations. But it said in the source book that relations are good. That's
Yeah, then that's not how Russia works, much less, you know, a bunch of paranoids who live in the basement of the Kremlin surrounded by moldering, glagolitic mythos tomes.
You kind of run into a, almost the Hellboy effect, right? Where you have this universal group that are paranormal investigators.
Yeah, and that's not what we're going to do.
That's okay over there, but that's not Delta Green.
No, and I mean, international relations in Delta Green are really awkward. You know, because if you're playing as Delta Green, the small group that kind of infiltrated some aspect of the Majestic group and then caused their shit to all fall apart, you know, you're going to have contacts with other people and other governments, and yet it's going to be constant political backbiting. You're never going to know.
The agendas are never going to match.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure I've very much expect to steal heavily from Malcolm Craig if I can't bring him aboard to help develop some of that stuff. But, you know, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be like suddenly we have the French on our side. You know, we have the Chinese on our side. You don't have anybody on your side. You know, you may be expected.
You don't even have the Air Force on your side.
Right. You may be expected to have meetings with the Brits or the Aussies or whoever, but that doesn't mean that you're any more likely to succeed at anything, because you never know. I mean, you can't even count on the people from your own country not turning around and jacking you around so that they can turn what you discovered into an advantage for them, as opposed to something that'll save lives.
And
let alone people that are not even from the United States of America.
Into, you know, the spy agency, so the spy genre, the intelligence genre. People seem to love to do it. But the thing that always struck me is that the paranormal, or evidence of the paranormal, or contact of the paranormal, is the one thing nobody's going to talk about, because they don't want to get sectionated or suddenly have to go to the mandatory, you know, counseling meetings and kill their career or get fired or get, you know, laid off. So
unless you have to.
Yeah.
Absolutely have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. That funny typo. You say I'm meeting the intelligence officer from Iran. Surely that means Iraq, right? Yes.
Yes.
Typo.
But, you know, and the supernatural, again, bear in mind, I mean, this is Delta Green, and that means anything that's supernatural is toxic. And it's toxic from root to branch. You know, Pisces in the UK, has a great psychics program that they developed way back when, and there are still aspects of that sort of floating around, and yet they're all crazy. And maybe they can tell the future, but which future are they telling? And are they telling you the truth or what? You know, any kind of supernatural stuff that's out there is destructive and poisonous.
Was it called the plutonium?
It's plutonium. I mean, that's sort of the fundamental theme. And so there's never going to be any kind of sense of a kind of overarching, all-knowing organization that has the answers, because there aren't answers.
Right.
And they don't have the magical resources, because the magical resources are going to either kill you or drive you insane, no matter how much you think you know about them.
Well, on that note, is the new Delta Green going to at least provide some sort of structure for, like, instead of running a Delta Green adventure in America, like running one overseas?
Oh, sure.
In Iraq.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying we're not going to address
the
international stuff. I'm just saying it's going to be horrible.
In the 2000s.
Okay.
Sometimes not dragged out, something, you know. But
yeah.
Yes, especially in the areas that, you know, we got ourselves stuck into good and hard, like Mesopotamia and Iraq and, you know, the Central Asia.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a lot of options for that.
Yeah, I mean, when you have a setting that keys heavily towards American law, federal law enforcement and intelligence, there's no getting around international relations in the last 10 years. So that's a factor, but it's not a factor to your player character's advantage. It's one more source of fear and misery. Yeah.
Guys, how are you guys going to handle the whole concept of the World Wide Web and the whole thing that, I mean, my God, riots start See, in Egypt, next thing you know, some guy with a cell phone camera, and he's got them all over the world, got
well,
the pictures.
Well, let's just say that there's some plans involving Katana Toa, and leave it at that.
Okay.
It's, yeah, no, well, I mean, yeah. It's, yeah.
It's
that's,
just
that's,
one more way for the mythos to hurt us.
I mean, right.
You know,
well, it's, I think
you mean,
I think
some sort
the,
of artificial
theme...
brain that's correlating content. That's, yeah, great.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess what you're looking, what you're talking about is the assumption in Delta Green Games is that it's all secret, right? And that you're fighting to keep it secret. And how do you keep it secret when information is so very easy to spread around?
Or
yeah,
when the college boy on the street corner with his. iPhone just takes a picture, just takes a little video of you doing something down and dirty.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly it's all over the web.
Yeah.
It just hit the conspiracies are us. Yeah, and next thing you know, Michelle Bachmann's talking about it. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, that works. Right. Yeah, I was going to say, you know, to a certain extent, that kind of exposure works works great for the people that want to keep it secret.
Yeah, there is that.
You know.
Crazy people
talking
about yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's like the Air Force. I mean, legitimately, literally, had a project to make
advance UFO
crazy UFO stories so that no one could tell what the real reports of real aircraft testing were.
If,
and they couldn't sort that out of the chat.
If
the guys who were there must have had the best job in the whole federal government because they produced some awesome stuff.
If you were to look on the internet right now and see a
like
YouTube video that said,
project.
You know, oh my God, this horrible monster came out of the ocean, look at it.
Mm-hmm.
You'd look at it and say, wow,
yeah.
Neat.
Someone has
a real future in Hollywood.
Yeah. But you wouldn't say to yourself, you know, oh my God, it's an immortal ancient deity.
I mean,
and
these things actually do happen. I mean, there were, you know, there's some horrible fire and people like say, look, it's the face of Satan over the fire.
Yeah,
and you
right?
can see it in the
thing. Everyone just goes
and
over
says, oh, look, it's the face of Satan. And
so,
if it's actually the face of Golgoroth, that doesn't actually make people believe it more.
So
I mean,
you know,
yeah, there's genuine weird stuff out there. The bloop,
bloop is awesome.
Bloop's neat.
I love bloop.
How about the times that Delta Green has turned up in people's conspiracy websites?
Yes,
where
those are my favorite.
Somebody went in and cribbed out all of the Yithian missing time material from Saucer Watch from the first Delta Green book. Somebody gone out and taken. All the material that I wrote about people who had suffered from missing time or amnesia cases, kind of like Wingate Peasley and Shadow of Time, and all these other cases. Somebody just cribbed that out, had that on their, you know, UFO, you know, aliens or Among Us site as more evidence of missing time, you know, word for word. And I wrote the guy, I'm like, so do you feel bad using clearly fictional shit I made up? And no, there's no response. But the best one was that woman's site where somebody threw a bunch of Delta Green stuff on it, and it was immediately followed by people going, yeah, man, these people sound ruthless. Who the fuck are these bastards? You know, who
this
are,
explains
you know,
so much.
It explains so much. And somebody, you know, just within a few posts, like I think this is from a game. And
I'm pretty sure
this
is
from a fictional book. And as soon as that came out, I was like, yeah, but they're telling you the truth between the lines. Pretend fiction, man. So that like they won't, you know, come to their house in the middle of the night in that little black limo and just splatter their brains.
There are deeper truths at work here.
Yeah, you just have to know how to read this stuff.
Genius to publish it as a game because no one can discover this secret coming out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
that was the
second
line
of
Delta Green.
Well,
I would say that
if it's on the internet. It must be true, you know.
Yeah, really. Sounds to me like you succeeded wildly, you know. And couldn't get, you know, you what? Are you the new Orson Welles now?
On a meta artistic level, sure. So,
yeah.
On a retire and sip Mai Tais by your mansion pool
and
level,
sell wine, perhaps. That's what I should do.
Go ahead.
So speaking of updating the perception of things, are you also looking at updating the major
antagonistic agencies, which Deltarune has dealt with, Majestic, sure. And organizations that may not be as directly culturally relevant, like Saucer Watch itself,
I'm going to say, very different. With the caveat that sort of stuff we're going to have to handle really carefully to avoid the whole meta plot issue. You know, we don't want
something that just says you know. Game masters should feel free
to destroy things.
I mean, if they, you know, I would hope that if people were playing a game and they were had Karatekia as their antagonist, that their keeper would not just keep snatching victory from their jaws if they actually came up with a way to, I don't know, turn Dr. Frank's refrigerator off, you know, or let's see, you can't kill Gulp with kinetic force. I know, let's hold the duct tape his mouth and nose shut. Mm-hmm. You know, no kinetic force involved there. He's sort of turning purple.
That's
you know, so much for him. You know, and then we'll take Bitterich and push him down a wheel, push his wheelchair down a staircase like Richard Widmark did in Kiss of Death. Okay, Karatekia done. You know, if they actually come up with ways to do that, I don't want the key there. I would hate to think their keeper go, well, we're gonna Fu Manchu it, and suddenly the guy you saw die is back again, or you know, without any good goddamn reason. I mean, yeah, okay, the Karatek is going to let essential salts thing go.
Good reason is because it's awesome for undying Nazis to come back again.
Yeah, I agree. But if they manage to fuck up the organization, it should just come back in the same form, resurrect in the same form, like the Phoenix.
Who they think they are, Hydra.
Yeah.
But, well, I mean, especially the Karatek. I mean, the whole point of the Karatek is you can beat them if you try hard enough.
Yeah. Certainly other antagonists, some of the minor antagonists we've come up with. I've always tried to, after that first book, it was always trying to come up with beatable antagonists. You know, they did not all need to be the Fate or Majestic.
Feel very beatable.
They needed to be things like, the Scopsy or
or Tiger Transit.
Tiger Transit, or yeah, guys you can fuck their shit up if you get in there and you act like, you don't kick the door and look for gold. I mean, if you do that, yes, you will fail. Like anyone will fail in a golf game. But if players have the kind of patience to really act, sort of play out a spy game that doesn't involve going to a really ritzy party and then sneaking away to steal the data off the computer in the middle of it, which every spy show on TV does these days, they can actually, like real spies, they could really do some damage to these groups and, you know, knock them off the list. That's why we keep coming up with new villains, is hopefully the players have had to kill a few of them, and then they want to go on to the next group that's dismantled, even if it costs them 3 or 4 player characters to do it.
Yeah, so we can, you know, I think the key is we can kind of bring some of those organizations forward without really going into too much detail. I mean, you know what Saucer Watch looked like in the 1990s. You know that they're probably not all that big a deal now. I don't think necessarily.
Saucer Watch, they could be in Delta Green now by now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a possibility. But you know, you don't necessarily need to have
that
a detailed, you know, blow by blow history of how that evolved. And, you know, it's got its role in the timeline.
As far as I'm concerned, you know, you have one line that says Saucer Watch went bankrupt in 2003 after an ill-advised tech startup.
Yeah, and if as a GM, you know, you have a great idea for spinning off an adventure about the fate of Saucer Watch, then do it, and we don't have to give you things that are going to contradict that.
You really do not want to get in the way of those kind of things happening.
But again, I mean, the trouble with updating the setting from 1997 to 2000 is we're going to get in the way of somebody's idea.
There's no way we can't. What we want to do is minimize the harm there. I mean, there are some key things that are so integral to the way Delta Green looks now that they have to be addressed. You know, that they have to be addressed in the timeline.
It's actually less realistic if Delta Green survived unchanged.
Right. Oh, yeah, and it's not. It's going to look radically different in a lot of ways.
What are you guys going to do about Phenomen X?
Phenomen X is as a, you know, as a
they're on Fox.
Show. They're on Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah, they're on Sci-Fi Channel.
Or some, you know, the History Channel probably.
Struggling reality TV.
They were going to be on, but they were interrupted by Shark Week. Phenomen X, like for instance, that's one of the things that really doesn't seem like it has to change its form terribly because that same, you know,
nonsensical
infotainment is still. Standard
operating. No, what you have is that the Phenomen X producer died under mysterious circumstances, and there was a special about what happened to this guy, and then the guy who made that special got his own spinoff version.
Yeah.
I mean, Phenomen X, quote unquote, you know, lasted four seasons.
Right.
And now there are two ripoff shows of Phenomen X.
Phenomen X, the original people are involved with.
Phenomen X colon something.
Yes.
Phenomen X, Watch the Sky, Danger Stories, and Phenomen X Las Vegas.
Thank you, audience. Your work here is done.
And Sonia Dewey is now in media relations for Majestic 12.
Something like that. Yeah. So a lot of things are not going to have to be changed at all. And we're trying to do, again, as little of that as possible because it just, I just want to leave room for people to make their own campaigns. And granted, Ken's right. You know, we're not going to be able to perfectly accommodate that because, you know, the guy whose Delta Green campaign had the hover fortresses and the, the F-14 Tomcats.
You bring him up every year.
I do.
Dennis does, too.
I don't know
who
that guy is, but I like to apologize and just beat the crap out of you every chance I get. But, the hover fortress was awesome. Almost as good as the Guinness. But...
And he has the power to hover fortress.
I can actually put up with the hover fortress being powered by Shoggoths running a little, you know,
Shog dragon belts.
Okay, you know, that's fine.
That's how the old
Techie Lee.
But as far as what's going to happen to each and every organization, you know, we're going to have to make a lot of decisions, very few of which have been made. There's some strong ideas about what to do about Majestic and Delta Green in a way to sort of, you know, bring these two...
Two crazy kids that hate each other yet just can't seem to stay apart.
They're like conjoined twins that were separated and now we're going to sew them back. It's not going to benefit either one of them in any way.
I mean, the fundament from that is in Dennis's book that'll be out next month in...
It'll be out next month?
Yeah, the electronic edition will be out next month, and then the print edition will probably be the month after that.
Okay,
but
I'm one of the Kickstarter contributors.
Well, thank you very much. His novel basically squarely addresses a lot of the stuff the way that a lot of the stuff we've been talking about evolves, and what we're going to be doing is going to deal with the 10 years after that.
And one of the things that, you know, John Tynes always wanted to say that the novels were totally non-canonical and that was just our idea of what should be going on. It's like a
Star Trek novel.
Basically. And it had nothing to do with the real canon is whatever's happening on your dining room table, you know. At the same time, though, some of the things that come out in Dennis' novel are
spaghetti.
Sort of, the end results of those things are going to be applied, even if the specifics are not specifically mentioned. The details of how we get to these points are not brought up in the role-playing game material. The results, many of the results will be, those I think are pretty much set in stone, those
results.
Well,
yeah, I mean, because they evolved out of an awful lot of conversations between all of us about the shape of things to come, so...
Can the same be said for his upcoming scenario anthology? Is that going to be more of the 90s cowboy mentality of Delta Green, or is that going to be more of the...
Has Dennis really addressed, you know, where to slip this in?
His next project is more fiction. It's not scenarios. Failed Anatomies is an anthology of short stories that kind of each of which is in a separate time period. So there's one that's in post Innsmouth, the end of the 20s, and another in the 40s and various decades that kind of hit the highlights of what it was like to be involved in Delta Green at each of those periods, and how it was awful no matter where you were.
I just remember Dennis Steinbaum really wanted to do some shit set in the '50s, you know.
So yeah, that's in there.
55, 57, you know, height of the Cold War, sort of period.
Yeah. So that's the big thing he's been working on in the aftermath of the novel, and then other stuff. I'm trying to think. The other stuff that he's been working most on have been
having.
Did you ever finish Future Perfect?
That's what he said in his correspondence to me. He said it was going to include a total revamp of that. And as well,
that's right. God, that's been so long ago. I totally forgot, and I was involved. I was performing that project.
A few of the adventures already on PDF.
Right, right.
Like
yeah, yeah. We had, yeah, we had that. We had an adventure collection in mind. Yeah, and it's kind of been in a holding pattern for a while, as you can tell by my total forgetting about it.
Things we have not done enough of probably is adventure scenario anthologies. Part of that is because we're limited to the Chaos and license, how many books we can do a year. And, adventure scenarios, for us, at least with Pagan, the adventure scenario collections are always harder to manage than source book material. Because
it's got to be tested.
Yeah, you have to throw it through at least two groups of players, and God knows. I've had plenty of stuff that was the most genius scenario ever, and it died. In the first hour of playtest, because I'm not as smart as I think I am.
Well, they're also hard to sell because the audience is so much smaller. You know, I mean, an adventure is really only valuable to one person.
Yeah, the keeper. But the weird thing,
financially valuable.
No, well, yeah, but that's what I'm talking about. That's what makes it harder to sell. It's harder to get your money back publishing adventures than it is publishing source books.
The source book materials, people are picking it up and going, it's like fiction. And
yeah,
it's still getting entertainment value from the buyers, even if they're not applying it to their role-playing game group. They're still
And yet, you know, that's stuff that's percolating, but it's very slow. And you know, he's kind of, since that was mainly his project, he's kind of got other things on his mind,
like his newborn child.
Yeah,
One of the things that a couple of things. First of all, the idea of gaming as literature. When Vampire the Masquerade first came out in the early 90s, my lady friend Nancy, who owns a bookstore, was moving it off the shelves, but I saw some of the customers like, wait a minute, these are like middle-aged housewives. I didn't know they don't, but they like vampires, and they like the story in there, the literature.
They did manage to sell a lifestyle rather than a game store.
Yeah, they basically wound up selling a lifestyle. So I don't think Delta Green's going to...
That's going to be a little harder. That lifestyle where you're, you know, let's see. Wake up with a half-empty bottle of bourbon in the bed with you and a gun on the nightstand.
Plus, a lot of the people who want to consume the Delta Green lifestyle don't have computers in their house because they thought, because the government looks at them through it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's pushing it more of the conspiracy sites as like possibly being maybe true. So, like, twice as many.
Yeah, there's no way that could ever come back to haunt us.
The other thing I wanted to bring up too is I'm on a lot of different forums. I talk to different, I go to different conventions, at least in the Florida, in Florida and that area. The biggest thing I've heard is, well, when's the next adventure coming out? And I'm like, don't you write your own? No. They need modules because as this one guy said, he said, I've got a wife and two kids, and I work 40 to 45 hours a week, and I haven't got time. Mm. But they're looking for stuff to run for their friends.
So the graying gamers no longer have the, they've got all these darn responsibilities. They want us to step up and do all the work for them.
But they do have disposable income.
Wait, what was that about disposable income again?
Yeah.
That's a counter argument to the idea that when you sell Delta Green to a scenario anthology, you're only selling it to the one guy in the group who's going to be running the games.
I think the big proof in that pudding is going to be how the next ransom looks.
Mm. Yeah, what people will throw their money at.
Yeah,
they'll throw their money at a scenario anthology or a campaign. I mean, I've got a Delta Green campaign that's kicking around the back of my head that you know, we've never tried producing a campaign before. I mean, there's the Dennis has this has the campaign that he was selling piecemeal, but you know, well, you know, it's not. I mean, is it going to sell? Is it going to be? You know, I'll be happy if I can manage to move 2,000. I'm not hoping that's going to be the next Mastodon or Thotep or anything. But
yeah,
we've never done it before. It's the kind of thing that it's, you know, it's got to get done because it's entertaining for me to play it. But whether or not we can get people to shell out money for it or not,
I think part of that too is to just kind of try to figure out what's currently hot and what's not. You know, what's going to grab people.
I don't think he had a problem fulfilling the ransoms for the Future Perfect model.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Those went up almost immediately.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just an idea, like, could you look into doing print-on-demand or, like, just PDFs for
Well, the problem is really just how big is the audience and how desperate are they for the material. You know, print-on-demand... has its uses, but if the audience is not there snapping it up, then it's not going to pay the bills.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to pay for the art and the layout. And
yeah,
shockingly, unlike writers, those darn artists and layout people want to get paid before they deliver the product. There, you know.
So
them.
Yes.
But the print on demand definitely has its value, but it's not the. It's not the solution.
It's not
the
silver bullet.
Right, yeah. It that doesn't increase your audience size. That's why we've been doing the ransom model for project after project, because that tells us, is there enough demand out there, and is there enough demand to pony up for it immediately such that we can get the bills paid and not just... have a product sitting in a warehouse and debts languishing. Waiting for that small audience to gradually get around to making a purchase.
I just want to make small... I'll offer to write Dennis's next adventures for him since he's so busy, because I know I know all I need to do is involve time travel and killing all the players
right.
What they do. So I think I can handle
that. Dennis's stuff always tends to be a lot more
lethal.
Vindictive.
Yes. Yeah. We talked about that, and if the Unspeakable Oath, we've got a podcast that comes out sporadically. So the second of its monthly episodes just came out a couple of weeks ago, after 2 months after the first one. So, but that's mainly me and Ross talking to Dennis, and we talk a lot about scenario design and you know, why he loves to kill player characters so much.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know why you have to try as a keeper.
Yeah, really.
You need to sit around going, and this is, you know. Yeah. But these great ideas on how to kill you, all you have to do is let them get up in the morning, find their car keys, and they're already in mortal danger.
Yeah, really.
Call it a game. I mean, was it a victim of the art with the Biaki?
Yeah.
I remember him saying something like, well, I'm going to change the Biaki in the scenario to be bulletproof or can't be harmed by physical weapons. And I'm like, why? I mean, it can maul the average group of players as long as it doesn't stand there like an idiot and let them shoot it, you know? There's a million ways you can use the Biaki to fuck up the players, as long as you don't, you know, play on their terms and on their rules. It's going to be plenty scary and plenty horrible. And, you know, even if, you know, it's killed, you just have to dump the amulet, bring a new one. Oh, we killed the monster, problem solved. And then, since you haven't dealt with the amulet, more just keep getting funneled into the scenario. Why make, you know, why tune up the monster just because, I don't like the idea of tuning up the monsters. Because, oh no, the players might have access to a side of 12 shotgun. And somehow that completely blows the game balance.
I think rather than the access to the shotgun, one of the problems I have, access to the monster manual.
Yeah.
Oh, look, it's a blue booger.
Yeah.
Oh, no, this is a 12th level and it has X amount of hit. Hell with that. Why does Great Cthulhu in my games doesn't have hit points?
Thank you, Trail.
You're welcome. Thank you, Sandy Peterson, for coming up with the idea in 1980.
Right.
And for not using it.
You're going to steal. That's right.
Yogg-Sothoth
has no hit points. You know?
Yeah.
Well,
he has no hit points, he's dead.
On that point, I'll just throw out that the next scenario anthology we're trying to put out a pig, and he has a whole bunch of non-mythos scenarios. So if your players have memorized all the critters in Malleus Monstrorum, they're fucked. There's nothing in there that's going to help them.
It's a Neo-Atyug!
In fact, there's nothing in their copy of Unspeakable Cults or the Necronomicon that their players have squirreled away that will help them in any way with any of these scenarios, because this stuff's from off the map.
It's all about puzzle fraud.
Yes. It's all about the critters, supernatural critters from, you know, existing mythologies.
Like Ross's zombies.
Well, they could, but all that could do with mythos.
It's a Hungarian count who drinks blood. How do we stop it?
Well, I will throw out that, you know, well, it's not in this scenario, but John Crow has a tendency to go find these mythological creatures that we're not ready for, because he's done research and we haven't. Like, my favorite were still the Udar, which were some sort of horrible Bedouin desert dwelling rape monsters that would rape the shit out of any hole they got near. The name of the scenario was A Fate Worse Than Death. I will just say that. There was this great moment where
as opposed to the first draft, which was Death by Wabunga.
Right. If only that was not true. The greatest moment for you is where Blair Reynolds, our artist, did all those covers. You
know, thanks a lot.
I'm losing the audience. Quick, change the subject.
It's not Bedouin rape monsters, not a big sell.
He's asked to come out of the room by the game.
Is it the rape of the Bedouins if we need to tone down?
That was Islamophobia.
Clearly they're not secure in their masculinity. He's taken out of the room to explain in detail what he's experienced after the monster has tackled him to the ground and himself on top of him. And he goes out of the room and he hears the hush, hush, hush in the other room, and all of a sudden I just hear, "No! No! 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 No!" He stomps back in, he sits in his chair, he's like, "Shut up!"
This is the player, Mark.
This is the player. Now, my least favorite part was, like, well, after we drive off the critters and we're trying to gather them, everybody, and get them on their camels to escape, there was a certain amount of first aid that had to be applied before people could get on their camels. Yeah, that was a sand loss.
I think I experienced a little sand loss just then. You know,
it's something I would love to be able to step away from the monster list, the Chaosium monster list, when we work into doing something that's going to be more.
That's going to definitely be an issue. And another issue is how to do it in a way that is not just completely cribbing from everything Ken already wrote in Trail. Yeah. But it's basically the same theory. You know, I mean, the key is we've got these monsters, they're out of Lovecraft, and here's sort of the traditional way to use them, and here's a few other ideas that you could use for them that the players aren't going to see coming, and that won't instantly clue them in on what they face and how to thwart it.
Actually, remind me next time I get a couple of days, I'll write something for the oath. It's, you know, four different ways to do deep ones, or four different ways.
Yeah, there you go.
I tell you,
submit your articles now. Mm-hmm. Get writing, all of you.
Yeah, one of the things that I found is
I keep meaning to do that for Trail.
Yeah, you hit them with something they're not even expecting. One of the scariest game sessions I ever ran was Traveler, the science fiction game where they ran into a ghost. And that whole table was so quiet. And this one friend of mine goes, "Frank, the hackles on the back of my neck just rose up for real."
Well, that's the kind of thing, that is exactly the kind of thing that I would like.
Because it was something that you didn't expect.
No. See, the parrot makes sense now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, it all comes
back. Got a cargo of parrots.
We ought to start wrapping it up. But go ahead, Mark.
just kind of an overall question. I mean, you've got the magazine coming out every month.
every quarter if I'm lucky.
Okay, well, you've got this magazine coming out on a regular basis. I mean, are there slots you keep finding yourself consistently wishing you had more entries for?
Oh, in the oath?
Well, I got three, so I guess I got to choose between these three. I really wish I had
You know, it's actually those short articles that everybody mentioned really loving. I don't get anywhere near enough of those. And you'd think we'd get lots of them because they're short.
It's
and
hard yet, to write short well.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. We get a fair number of scenarios, and we get a fair number of scenarios that are good. And that's not to say don't submit a scenario, because you know we need them, and we get some that aren't so good. But the shorter things, the Tales of Terror and the Arcane Artifacts and those things where it's a sort of self-contained thing that you can either throw in as a red herring or that you can spin a campaign off of. We don't get anywhere near as many of those as I'd like to see. So any ideas that you guys have that something hits you and you have that moment where you go, ooh, I can't wait to throw that at my players, write it down and send it, because we need those. All right. Can we wrap it up? Anybody got a desperate emergency question that they're going to die if they don't ask? Because I think we're about out of time. Okay. Well, cool. Scott,
yes.
Monty, and Ken, and Greg, thank you.
Yeah, guys. Thanks. Yeah.
Thanks for buying the books, folks.
Yeah. All right. I'll tell you the end.
Cool.